From our New York studios, Mutual presents Bill Cunningham, whose writings are syndicated from coast to coast. In just a moment, Bill Cunningham brings his column to Mutual listeners. But first, an important reminder. Remember that old proverb, it's later than you think? Now's the time to plan for, to build for a secure tomorrow. Yes, take the time now to make your future secure. The savings bond way. The easiest, safest way to save for the future is to buy United States savings bond through the part payment payroll savings plan where you work. Join the payroll savings plan. It's the automatic, systematic way to save for the future. If you're self-employed, join the bond a month plan at your bank. Remember, United States savings bonds return $4 for every three saved in just 10 years. And they're absolutely guaranteed by the United States government. They're lost, stolen, or destroyed, your government will replace them without charge. So don't delay. Your country's future won't wait. Buy United States savings bonds. And now, Bill Cunningham.
This is Bill Cunningham speaking today from New York City, where the four foreign ministers have been meeting in an effort again to find the start toward a peace for Austria. Where the atomic delegates have been in fruitless session, their eighth fruitless session, the United Nations General Assembly reconvened with a formidable agenda out on Long Island. But it's a New York City which is wild at the moment with baseball fever, as the two tightest major league pennant races since 1908 came to this final day of the scheduled season with the issue still in doubt. A fast check of key cities of the nation. Such representative centers as Boston, Richmond, Chattanooga, Atlanta, Chicago, Omaha, Dallas, Denver, Salt Lake City, Phoenix, Minneapolis, San Francisco, and Los Angeles brings in the news that the situation is about the same there. Some communities are concerned with local problems or national or international issues that chance to concern them directly. Pittsburgh and the Detroit area are watching the steel strike for understandable reasons. Utah is concerned about the number of escapees from its state penitentiary. The Upper South, worrying over the recent administration approval of a $14.3 billion rural electrification bill to set up 11 miniature TVAs in Virginia. San Francisco is bothered by the repercussions of the long-drawn-out dock strike in Hawaii, as efforts to unload Hawaiian pineapples on the West Coast, despite picket lines, have brought those troubles to these shores. But in with all these reports comes word that the citizens of those sections are too seriously and happily infected with the annual and traditional autumnal complaint, entirely mental of character, fortunately, and known as World Series fever. That includes, of course, your reporter, whose sympathies naturally are with the Boston Red Sox. And I think this raises a healthy and hopeful sign in all of us. If the world were all it ought to be, we'd have nothing more threatening and bewildering than this and similar things to worry about. And furthermore, if those who try to rule nations would only throw away their treaties, advisors, their armies, atomic projects, and all the rest of it, and turn exclusively to the code of sports as a pattern for handling international and other affairs, all these troubles, doubts, fears, and terrors would automatically fade away. If somebody had to boil the rules of all the sports to one sentence, he could do it very easily. In fact, he wouldn't have to boil, for that sentence has been on the public records and in the hearts of all fair and decent men for 2,000 years. It couldn't be anything but do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And it's known, of course, as the Golden Rule. Almost everybody knows it, but there may be many who don't know who first said it. You'll find those words in your New Testament. They are the words of the Prince of Peace, the peace the world still is seeking after 2,000 and many more thousand before those years. Those words were first spoken by the gentle and compassionate Christ himself in his Sermon on the Mount. They were laid down there for all the future, as a pattern by which men could live and should live in full harmony together. And I don't want to sound sacrilegious, but the world of sport at least keeps that faith and is obligated to keep it today. Its code is, don't take an unfair advantage. Don't hit below the belt. Don't cheat. Don't slug. Don't lie. Respect your opponent's rights to do everything that you do, as long as you both keep it even and fair. And where else in this harassed world today can you find it? And how easy it all would be if, in both the domestic and international contests, we all played ball only that way. But with a salute to the ideal and a prayer that it yet may prevail, let's turn to the hard facts of what is actually taking place. New and tough is the steel strike. Added to the coal strike in which John L. Lewis has finally achieved the ultimate of a no-day week. They are hopeful in Washington, but the best information in Washington and elsewhere is that the steel strike is really a strike, and that it may run for weeks or months or possibly well into the winter. The press in New York today and in most other cities has been quick to note the serious threat to far more than just the steel industry and its dividends or the welfare of its workers in this now official impasse. If the strike is a long one, and regardless of who wins, it's our entire economy that's jeopardized. And it's an economy considered to have pulled itself neatly through and out of at least a recession that well might have become a depression. And now, especially when all hands seem agreed that if Russia hasn't the atomic secret, she's well on her way toward getting it, and that this calls for new planning, new spending, possibly new taxes and new production, the complete stoppage of production is a threat to the nation, if not to the world peace. Considering it just as a strike, of course, we know what will happen. The companies and the unions will stand deadlocked for a period, long or short. The companies will lose production. The workers will lose their wages and savings, most of them no doubt landing on relief sooner or later, which means on their fellow citizens. And finally, there'll be a compromise, meaning a new contract of long or short tenure. And any and all costs the companies are handed will be passed on to the public. It really seems that some new sort of process for handling these things will have to be worked out. The present form of the strike is as outmoded as the horse and buggy. Originally, the strike was a fight to the death between the union and the company. One or the other generally died as a result, and it was usually the union. If the company had enough money, it generally won. The union was broken and out of business. If the workers could hold on long enough and were bitter enough and could see work elsewhere enough, they could put the company out of business, and they sometimes did. But those days are gone, for better or for worse, at least so far as putting the unions out of business are concerned, and certainly for putting anything as huge and as vital as the steel industry out of business is concerned. And yet, here we go in the same old pattern of the 90s, right when we need our entire team on the field in the new and suddenly far harder game. Now, as to whether the game is actually getting harder, most of the interest around the United Nations meeting here in New York concerns the next move or moves between the Russians and Tito, and especially the next moves of ours. The break between Russia and Yugoslavia is now official since our old friend, Mr. Gromyko, called the Yugoslavian charge of the affairs into his office in Moscow last week and handed him a letter stating that Russia was abrogating, was tearing up their mutual friendship treaty. It was supposed to last for 20 years, and it was only 4 years old. Then followed the chain explosion of renunciations from the other satellites, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, and today newly Romania. The Western world, at least, was shocked at this brazen Russian exhibition of how little their pledged word in the form of a solemn treaty means, and possibly of how completely they control the border countries around them, exclusive of Yugoslavia. The question, of course, is what now, and especially what now for us? Our State Department is tight-lipped, but it undoubtedly is figuring. The trouble between Tito and Russia seems to be a break over the interpretation of communism. Tito's a communist, but he seems to be maintaining the right to run his own communism as a national project with himself as its dictator. And Russia's position seems to be that all communism must be dictated from Moscow, that Tito or some Yugoslav can serve as the chief local agent, but the top authority must reside in the Kremlin. Our authorities must have no illusions concerning Tito. Incidentally, we still have the shame of the abandoned Mikhailovich staining our post-war international soul because we deserted him, our man, allowing Tito, the former bootlicker of Stalin, officially to murder him through a trial for treason. The truth on Tito, of course, is that he's a slimy opportunist who used Russian backing to seize the power in his country and is now trying to shed his backers and grab the entire loot. Because the unfortunate balance of good and evil in the world forces us to stoop to compromise, we are now in the uncomfortable position of having at least to consider the sponsorship of this impudent scoundrel, only because, as it's phrased, he possibly represents the first break of the satellites from the common form. In other words, through him we may inspire the rebellion of the rest. That's saying it the hard way, of course. What we want is freedom for the rest and freedom for all the world's people everywhere. About the best you can say for Tito is that he has plenty of courage or possibly plenty of desperation, for he's geographically within reach of Russia. His nation's not a big one. It's only about twice the size of Pennsylvania, and most of it's pretty primitive. But it's well to remember that if he turned on Stalin, he could even more easily turn on us, because we're much farther away. But such, at least, is our new buddy over against the Iron Curtain. We've just granted him a $2 million license to buy a steel mill, and they've loaned him $20 million to buy some machinery. We'll probably be lucky if Russia doesn't wind up with both. There's been no confirmation out of Russia about the atomic bomb, but there's plenty of wild claim and plain conjecture from almost everybody else. That was forecast here a week ago, and it promptly proceeded to come to pass. And no matter what you hear or read, most of it, in fact, I'd say all of it, is guesswork. Various authorities are quoting what they claim to be almost unchallengeable informers to prove this and that. Some of these are said to be Russian escapees who worked on the project or who know about the project and who got out into Italy, Western Germany, Sweden, or some such. The fact that most of it's phony is proved by the fact that there still is conflict instead of jibe. The one that seems to make the most sense says that Russia was working on the bomb, a fact we'll all have to accept, but that she blew herself up with the first one. Not within recent weeks, as President Truman said, but about a year ago. And that was my own educated guess last Sunday. This version continues to say, however, that from that mistake, the mistake of overcharging the thing because they didn't know how much to put in it, the surviving Russian scientists learned much, and that they learned probably enough. But I said last week here that I hoped Russia does have this, at least the secret of the bomb and possibly the bomb itself. And as shocking as that sounds, I said it because, according to our authorities, she was bound to get it eventually anyway. And my reasoning is that the sooner she did, the sooner we could talk as equals about abandoning and outlawing the whole business. In the day's news, I see I have a distinguished supporter of that theory, none less than Prime Minister Nehru of India, speaking from New Delhi, as he left yesterday for the United States. Not to try to bracket myself with this distinguished successor to Mahatma Gandhi at all, he nonetheless said the news didn't shock him because the news was inevitable, and that he, too, now hopes for peace. A peace achieved not through love but fear, but a peace, nonetheless, through which possibly love or at least understanding may be found. This is Bill Cunningham of the Boston Herald speaking from New York City and saying thank you very much.
Have you ever received a summons to serve on a jury? Why, quite possibly then, you may have wondered how your name was chosen. Well, in some states, the names of prospective jurors are taken from the local assessment rolls, and in others, from the voting registration ballots. Jurors are chosen by lot according to the sequence of names on the lists. The whole procedure is marked with the strictest honesty and impartiality. Both plaintiff and defendant are assured of a jury of open-minded, unbiased citizens who are concerned only with the true facts in each case. This is democracy in action. Trial by jury is a right guaranteed by the Constitution to every American. And while you probably will never face a court as a defendant, that right to trial by jury still protects you. It protects all Americans against injustice and intolerance. So when you're called to serve on a jury, answer that call gladly, willingly, and with a full sense of responsibility. You'll be helping to carry out the just administration of our laws. You'll be safeguarding freedom. And freedom is everybody's job. Bill Cunningham spoke to you today from New York City. This is the World Series Network, the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Insert statement by President Plaza of Ecuador on the earthquake. This will delay smoke rings 4.5 minutes. That's President Plaza of Ecuador tonight at 8:30 p.m. New York time. That's all for now.